from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A deadly coordinated attack on the Afghan parliament took place Monday in Kabul, in which 8 people, including all 6 gunmen, were killed, leaving dozens injured. The Taliban claimed responsibility for the attack. The parliament was holding a vote on a new defense minister when a car bomb was detonated outside the compound. The site was then stormed by gunmen who attempted to enter the parliament building. Diane Penn reports.
The deputy head of the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, Tadamichi Yamamoto, strongly condemned the attack, calling it a clear and deliberate affront to democracy in the country. The UN mission reiterated that all parties to the conflict in Afghanistan, including the Taliban, are bound by international humanitarian law, which prohibits attacks against civilians. This includes civilian government workers. Meanwhile, the Geneva-based Interparliamentary Union, the IPU, called for greater support and protection for parliamentarians in what it described as a difficult and often violent environment. The IPU said militants have repeatedly targeted Afghan members of parliament, resulting in several assassinations or injuries in recent years. Diane Penn, United Nations.
The UN Secretary General's Special Representative for Afghanistan, Nicholas Haysom, said Monday that 4,200 civilians have been killed or injured in the country since the beginning of 2015. Haysom cited increasing aggravation of the conflict between government forces and militants, even in areas that had been considered safe. Afghan security forces say they are working to the limit as they take over control of the situation after the withdrawal of foreign troops. A new NATO rapid response force in East Europe could reach 40,000 troops, a tenfold growth from the initial 4,000-strong force deployed last year, that according to NATO's Secretary General, with most of the troops to be stationed near the borders of Russia. The rapid strike force has apparently already been more than tripled to 13,000, Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said Monday, adding that there would be an announcement next week of an increase to 30,000 to 40,000 troops. Special forces and rapid response teams, he said, will be reinforced with marine and air components. The chill in Russia-U.S. relations already resemble the worst years of the Cold War, yet experts warn that further escalation of the Ukrainian crisis could lead to an open standoff between Moscow and Washington. One such expert is Dr. Gerald Horn, who holds the John Jay and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History at the University of Houston.
This is a very dangerous turn of events. First of all, we must condemn in unvarnished terms the adventurism of the U.S. authorities in sending more armament to Russia's western borders. I think in order to understand this, we have to recognize, number one, that during the Cold War, there was a fair amount of anti-Moscow sentiment generated in the United States of America. That is to say, the United States was the Soviet Union was castigated as the evil empire. And therefore, it's very easy and simple for certain U.S. politicians to play up on that anti-Moscow sentiment today. Second of all, we now recognize, retrospectively, that the Cold War was more than about communism, as we were told. U.S. geostrategists now acknowledge that Russia is the most valuable territory on this small planet because it is the land bridge between the richest continent that is Europe and the continent of the future that is Asia. And therefore, the United States wants to dominate, if not control, Moscow. I'm afraid that it's difficult to be optimistic at this precise moment. We can only hope that U.S. geostrategists will recognize that their hands are full. They're trying to confront the so-called Islamic State on the Syria-Iraqi border. They're trying to confront China in the South China Sea. And one would think that that was enough and that sober heads would prevail in Washington, and therefore they would pull back from the brink and the precipice and say that the armament going to Russia's western borders will not be sent. Keep in mind that the United States pursues what could be called a strategy of chaos. That is to say, before the Ukraine crisis of February 2014, there was concern in Washington that Germany was drawing too close to both Moscow and Beijing. Germany, as you know, has been a major investor in Russia over the last decade or more. With the Ukraine crisis that has erupted, The United States has pressured Germany to put sanctions on Russia, and now it's upping the ante by sending these armaments to Russia's western borders. This is in part a strategy to keep Berlin in line.
15 people were killed and dozens others wounded in airstrikes across Yemen Sunday. The U.S.-supported airstrikes by Saudi forces have been bombarding the country since March 26th, killing thus far over 2,800 people. CCTV's Xin Zheming filed this report from Yemen's capital, Sana'a.
In the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, a residential neighborhood adjacent to a military base was struck Saturday evening by Saudi-led coalition airstrikes.
Yesterday around 5 p.m. in the evening, a plane was hovering in the sky overhead, and suddenly it fired a missile and it reached the door. We went inside and many homes were destroyed.
The official Sabah news agency said at least 5 people were killed in attack, and witness said at least one child was among the victims.
In the house was a family of 3 kids and a daughter and a mother and a father. The oldest son was killed and the father is in intensive care and the rest were injured. In my house, 3 girls and 2 boys were injured.
The Saudi-led coalition has been bombarding since March the 26th. More than 2,800 people have been killed since. The United Nations says more than 21 million people, or 80% of the population, are now estimated to be in need of some form of humanitarian aid or protection. UN-sponsored talks in Geneva between Yemen's warring parties ended last Friday, but no agreement on a ceasefire was reached. Xin Zheming, CCTV.
This past Friday, a first round of peace talks in Geneva ended without agreement, leaving, however, according to the UN's special envoy, the possibility of a ceasefire soon after further meetings. The envoy stressed, however, that the Geneva consultations were only at an initial stage and aimed at halting the conflict. Stephanie Kotrix filed this report.
As the consultations drew to a close in the Swiss city, Ismail Ould Sheikh Ahmed, speaking through an interpreter, said that while there was no ceasefire yet, the groundwork had been laid for one pretty soon.
We should all realize that the Geneva consultations are not the end in itself, but a launch of a long and arduous path to get back Yemen to a transitional political phase.
The UN special envoy for Yemen described his week of meetings with government and opposition delegations as an achievement. But both sides had diverging views, he said, and because of the great tragedies and pain of the current conflict, it wasn't to be expected that a single meeting in Geneva would bring them together. Ismail Ould Sheikh Ahmed also stressed the desperate humanitarian crisis in the country caused by the conflict, which he said cannot wait anymore. And he said he would redouble his efforts to secure a pause in fighting so aid can get through to the 21 million people who need it in Yemen. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
The Gaza conflict last year caused unprecedented devastation and death, especially in the Palestinian territories, that according to the UN's investigators, Monday. The UN Independent Commission of Inquiry on the 2014 Gaza conflict released its much-awaited report Monday at a press conference in Geneva. According to the report, the commission gathered substantial information pointing to the possible commission of war crimes by both Israel and Palestinian armed groups during last summer's fighting. The 2014 war saw huge firepower used against Gaza, with more than 6,000 airstrikes on the densely populated city by the Israeli air forces, along with approximately 50,000 tank and artillery shells fired into the city. In the 51 days of attacks, the report said that at least 1,462 Palestinian civilians were killed, a third of them children. The report also said that rockets and mortars fired at Israel by Palestinian armed groups killed 6 civilians. Daniel Johnson has more.
Citing possible war crimes in her report from both sides, Chief Investigator Mary McGowan-Davis questioned the Israeli military's conduct during the conflict. She said there was a crying need to address the extensive use of Israeli weapons with a wide kill and injury radius in densely populated areas. And she also spoke of an apparent pattern whereby Israeli forces issued evacuation orders to neighborhoods and then automatically considered anyone left behind to be a target.
The most that we can hope for is that we will push the ball of justice a little further down the field by calling on governments to stand up and join together to address the crying need for changes in policies regarding the use of explosive weapons with wide area effects in densely populated urban areas.
For their part, the report found that Palestinian groups fired nearly 7,000 rockets and mortars at Israel indiscriminately and with the intention of spreading terror. In addition, Israeli civilians had been left traumatized by the discovery of 14 tunnels used by Palestinian armed groups to attack Israeli soldiers during the 51-day conflict. Daniel Johnson, United Nations, Geneva.
The commission was appointed by the UN Human Rights Council in September of 2014 to investigate all violations of international humanitarian law and international human rights law in the context of the military operations conducted last summer. The commission consists of American Justice Mary McCowan Davis and Dr. Dudu Diagne from Senegal. Nevertheless, the report may end up facing a dead end when it goes to the UN Security Council, where the U.S. has veto power, for possible referral to the International Criminal Court. This was U.S. State Department spokesperson John Kirby at his daily press conference Monday after the release of the report.
Can you comment on what the United States will do next? Apparently, the report will go before the Security Council, then it will go to the ICC. Will you support any of that effort?
Again, we've expressed concerns about the mechanism itself. So I don't foresee any a U.S. role here in the process of it moving forward. Mm-hmm. We've expressed concerns about this commission of inquiry from the get-go, and I don't have anything for you.
Israeli authorities refused repeated requests by the commission for information and direct access to Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories to conduct their investigation. The commission did obtain firsthand testimony by means of Skype, VTC, and telephone interviews, and conducted face-to-face interviews with victims and witnesses from the West Bank during two visits to Jordan. Commissioners also spoke to victims and witnesses from Israel who traveled to Geneva. Altogether, the commission conducted more than 280 confidential interviews and received some 500 written submissions. After the report was presented by Commissioners Davis and Diagne Monday, they took questions from the press.
On the when you're talking about the indiscriminate attacks on civilians and especially buildings and where families were killed, and you mentioned that there seems it raises questions about the responsibility all the way up to the highest levels of government. Could you tell us a little bit more about that and what sort of indications have you seen that there has actually been a chain of command allowing this to happen?
I haven't seen any specific indications that a chain of command has allowed this to happen, but I think in our report we hint at the notion that when this is a 51-day operation, I believe it was, and when it becomes clear very early on during the course of the hostilities that huge numbers of families are dying in these houses that are targeted by large bombs, that it must become apparent to somebody that actually whatever the rules of engagement are that are supposed to protect civilian lives are not being very effective. And so that those who were in a position to make the kinds of decisions to change the course of an operation would seem to me, should have done so. And I guess we would look at circumstantial evidence in that way, but certainly nothing direct.
One more point, I think one criteria for assessing the degree of command or no command is this fact, the simple fact that I think our report tried to show it, that despite, because this war has been maybe one of the best covered war by the media. You have been seeing the pictures daily, every evening, every day. Despite the fact that the destructions have been on both sides, and the consequences of the rocket or the destruction of building have been shown repeatedly, daily, day after day, there was not any thing which shows that there has been a decision to stop or diminish the number of attack on building and civilians. So the criteria that the repetition and the continuation of bombardment on both sides and destruction pictured by you, media, every day, is an indication that somewhere, somehow, in this chain of command, there has been a position which allow this. So as a commissioner, we have to raise the question, and we are raising the question.
Yes, good afternoon. You have some recommendations for the Israelis and the Palestinians. My question is, have you presented these recommendations in a sort of formal manner already? And what is the response of the Israelis and the Palestinians?
I'll make sure I understand the question. After we present the recommendations in a formal way, what is their reaction?
Oh, yes. You said that you have some recommendations for the Israelis and the Palestinians. And my question is, have you presented these recommendations already to the concerned parties? And if so, what's their reaction?
No, we have just released the report. We will present our formal findings and recommendations to the Human Rights Council. I believe it's a week from today, June 29th, and I think that's probably where we'll begin to hear officially what the reactions of some of the governments are. I'm reminded that I should add that we have shared copies of the reports with them, but only a few hours ago.
Given your statements that there's been a lamentable record on Israel's part in terms of starting criminal proceedings against potential perpetrators or past perpetrators, I should say, how do you see this playing out in the council? There's also a move, I think, by the Palestinians are meant to be making a submission to the ICC this week. Do you think that would be the appropriate forum to follow up on your testimony that you've gathered? Would the ICC be the appropriate step via Security Council, presumably?
Okay. It is not my specialty, Mary. No, I think your question is right, but you certainly understand that the main forum where the report will be debated in detail, because of the time given to them, is the Human Rights Council. And certainly, from now on to the 29th of June, all parties concerned will carefully study all parts of the report, not only the presentation of the investigation of the incident, the fact-finding dimension, but also the accountability part, and the one part related to responsibilities. And there is no doubt that at the Human Rights Council, the parties concerned will express themselves on this very sensitive point. Our mandate was just these three parts. We try to cover them as precisely and objectively as possible.
Well, just to follow up on that, I mean, you say specifically that in relation to the failure to change the policies and the conduct of the war, existing mechanisms may not be sufficient to address the possibility that there may have been war crimes. So what mechanisms do you think are appropriate, and why are the existing mechanisms inadequate?
This is a hard question to answer. Obviously, Israel has a very, starting with Israel, there's many aspects to this question that should be answered. But starting with Israel, they have, of course, a very robust judicial system. They're very proud of the rule of law that obtains in their country. They have, of course, investigated after the 2010 conflict. The Turkle Commission published a report, one part of which was to deal with the accountability mechanisms and whether Israel's system, particularly of investigations, complied with international standards. Turkle Commission recommended that 18 changes be implemented. Certainly one of our recommendations is that they should follow through with that process, because some of the more significant recommendations, like legislating commander responsibility in Israeli law, you know, would go a long way, possibly, to achieving some sort of accountability for persons higher up in the military hierarchy and civilian hierarchy. There's also an ongoing commission of inquiry, as I understand it. That's actually not a commission of inquiry. I'm sorry, it's a controller's investigation that's going to address some of the policy-making issues that, of course, have arisen since last summer. One accountability mechanism that I think has been effective in Israel in the past is a commission of inquiry. There are some suggestions that there should be a permanent one with subpoena power and with the real political respect, so to speak, of the community that might go some way to addressing some of these accountability issues. With respect to Palestinian Authority, we did hear from them that they are attempting to put measures in place. They are, I believe, attempting to abolish capital punishment, among other measures, but they did not appear to have control of the situation on the ground in Gaza last summer. With respect to the local authorities in Gaza, I think it's fair to say that there have been no effective accountability measures to date, and I'm not necessarily persuaded about the prospect of any such measures being arranged for in the near future. Dudu, do you want to be heard?
Yes, just one. No, I just want to add one point. What we did in our report, I think it is fair, because accountability dimension is one very important part of our mandate. We try to present the information given to us on the mechanism of on both sides as far as accountability is concerned. And you will see in the report the description and of the mechanism taken by the different parts. But we end up critically assessing the insufficiency of this accountability mechanism. And we raise question on the necessity to strengthen them or to take measure which shows that there is a political will to go much deeper on the accountability mechanism. So our on the accountability issue, there is a presentation, a detailed presentation of what both sides are doing, having taken a decision, but we end up with a critical assessment of the insufficiency of this mechanism so far.
To follow up on that, I mean, the report specifically references the failures of Israeli political and military leadership to change course and says existing mechanisms may not be adequate. And so, again, the question is, where do you think this, what kind of mechanism should take up these particular failures?
Well, as I've indicated to you, I think commission of inquiry might be an appropriate mechanism in Israel. I suspect you're wanting me to utter the words ICC or initials. Obviously, this situation is different from prior commissions and prior independent committees that I have sat on, because there is a process in place at the moment. I'm not going to go near, you know, I mean, they're going to do their thing. And of course, I think everyone in the international criminal law business recognizes that countries that do, you know, show that they have the will and the intent robustly to prosecute criminal activity in their own courts and their own judicial systems might then, be expected to do so and then not be concerned about a future prosecution in The Hague. But that process is ongoing, and we have certainly recommended and do so strongly to all members of the international community that they should cooperate with that process. And I include Israel in that recommendation, as does Dudu, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I would like to add, Mary, that one point, a critical point we made to assess the mechanism of accountability mechanism is the criteria of independence. And we end up raising a question on the degree of independence of this mechanism. So this point, we think, is an important point. So.
I'm just going to add, I think I misspoke when I said investigation. I understand that what is underway by the ICC is a preliminary examination. That's different from an investigation, and I apologize for having misspoken.
Sorry to insist, but you ask accountability, you repeat what you want them to do, but then you yourself regret that they have closed investigation regarding the four kids that they were killed at the beach. So how do you expect us and the world to think that something bigger is going to be, they are going to do if such a obvious crime happened and nothing's been done? Thank you.
Well, we do address the question of the four boys on the beach and the investigation that was reported. Really, it was only a week ago, I think, that the MAG reported the results. Very disappointing. I concur. I think that was our position. You'll see it discussed in the longer report. Certainly, the understanding that many of you or many journalists who were present at the hotel, I've stayed at that hotel, who were right there when this happened on the public beach, were not actually spoken to. Nobody has made public, to my knowledge, the actual drone pictures that they say made these little boys, 9-year-old, 10-year-old boys, look like, you know, 20-year-old militants, what have you. So I think it's very disappointing, and it does not necessarily augur well for, you know, what the investigative process will demonstrate here. But we all share your concern about that, and I think we have addressed that at some length in our report.
And as you will see in our report, we did meet witnesses. And some of the people who came to meet us in Amman and here to give us information on this incident. But I just would like to add that certainly we have objectively tried to describe what we heard. But given the impact of this incident, the four boys, many of your media did cover it and publish an article, detailed article about it. And certainly one of the article from The Guardian has been one key element of information on the incident. So certainly we do hope that the elements we are bringing and the question we are raising in the global issue of accountability, as far as this incident is concerned, and the way the debate has already started on the decision taken already or what may be taken already, what we are hoping is that the issue is open, and that after reading our report and as a follow-up to the very profound debate on these cases, maybe there is a possibility of an opening or a progress on the accountability issue, because this case is particularly sensitive and has touched so many people. But I may add that also we have raised another point, which is that we got from the two sides, from parents who have been victims, who had their family members killed, or we will not give names, the statement after presenting their case, their suffering in some very moving terms, we have heard on both sides the statement that they are sensitive to what is happening on the other side. That one mother from the kibbutz on side who received the rocket did tell us that, yes, she was thinking about the mothers on the other side. And also another Palestinian father told us how he received some support from Israeli citizen and others. So the point I'm making here is that we have got this very message, which is very complex, that there has been, beyond the suffering of the victim, some cases where victim did tell us, yes, we have been suffering, we are suffering still, but we are thinking about the other side suffering also. So we think that this point is very hopeful and important for the future.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.